Chapter 9. Steel.
Hello, Liam.
Come in. Father Casey stood aside to let him enter the apartment. It was a small place, barely furnished, on the third floor of a walk-up on East 74th Street. Liam Casey was dressed in jeans and a t-shirt with a black shirt front and a Roman collar over it.
I'm sorry I didn't call first, Steele said. I know it's been a while.
Since when do friends have to worry about dropping in on one another? Liam Casey said. Sit down and take a load off. It's good to see you. Will you have a drink? Steele hesitated.
Yeah, why not? Got any beer?
Cold one coming right up.
Were you on your way out?
It can wait, said Father Casey. I was just getting ready to go down to the church. He went over to the refrigerator, took out two bottles of cold beer, and brought them over to the table.
I have to explain something to you, Liam. I'm not sure how to say this, but
I know all about it. Steele raised his eyebrows.
You do?
Yep. Some of your government people paid me a call. It seems they figured you'd be coming to see me sooner or later, and wanted to give me what they called a briefing. They explained the whole thing to me. Apparently, they were a bit nervous about what I might say to you. Steele moistened his lips.
And what do you have to say?
Liam Casey curled his hands around the beer bottle. Well, I guess it depends on what you want to hear, he said.
I think you know that too.
You're worried about your soul.
Yeah, he paused. Have I still got one?
Well, unless you've gone and sold it to the devil, then I imagine you still do. Taking a man's soul isn't something other men can do.
Is that what they told you to say?
Come on, you know me better than that. Steele grimaced.
Yeah, I guess I do. I'm sorry, Liam.
No need to apologize. How do you feel?
Confused, I guess.
Father Casey nodded. Well, if you want the official position of the church, I can tell you that we don't have a set policy on where a person's soul is. I don't know that's a decision for us to make, if you get my meaning. We tend to second-guess the Lord a bit too much as it is, but then it's a complicated world and we have to do our best. It isn't often easy.
What do you think, personally?
Personally, you mean as a priest or as a friend?
Both, I guess.
Well, as a priest, I think that since you never actually died, then you still got your soul. Despite all the advances of medical science, I still don't know of any operation that can remove it. And as a friend, I don't think you're being tested about as sorely as a man could be. Artificial arms and legs don't make you a machine. And while you may have a cybernetic brain, what I hear talking to me isn't a computer, but my old friend Donovan Steele. Confused, perhaps, and a bit more frightened, but still the same man I knew. Liam Casey smiled. There was nothing strange in the way he looked at him. Steele felt enormously relieved. He'd been dreading this meeting, afraid of how Liam would react.
But is that how the church would feel?
He asked. Well, now, I'm not the Pope, said Liam, for which Rome is probably heaving a great sigh of relief. But they've got more than enough problems these days. But I don't think you could be excommunicated for having an electronic brain. I could be wrong, of course, but at the risk of speaking heresy, even if you were, I don't think being cast out of a church would necessarily cost you your soul. We've gotten a bit high and mighty on occasion, but the last judgment still isn't up to us, you know. Legally, well, that's another matter entirely. What the law decides and what God ultimately decides may well be two very different things. There quite frequently are, I suspect, but that's neither here nor there. I can tell you that I think you're still human. The bishop might tell you something different. The cardinal might disagree with the bishop, and I suspect Rome's far too busy trying to keep what's left of the church together to want to get involved in anything like this right now. The point is, in the final analysis, no matter what anybody tells you, they would only be subjective opinions after all. And when all said is said and done, I'd say the only opinion that really matters is your own.
I wish it was that easy, said Steele.
Well, nothing ever is, you know, especially in your case. There's never been a man who's received an artificial brain before. You never really had an opportunity to become prepared for it, and it's understandably causing you a great deal of distress. People often turn to the church in times of stress, seeking reassurance. Easy answers. Well, sometimes we can provide them. Should you covet your neighbor's wife? No, you shouldn't. Should you steal? No, you shouldn't do that either. Should you kill? No, that's a mortal sin. You say that you don't like psychiatrists, but that's really the role you're expecting me to play, and frankly, I'm not qualified. I may possess a bit more than a layman's knowledge of psychology, but I'm no therapist. Don't misunderstand. I'm always here for you as a friend or as a priest. But if I gave you the reassurance that you seek, would you really accept it at face value? Would it dispel your doubts? He shook his head and took another sip of beer. I don't really think it would. I'd really like to help you, Steele, he said with feeling. But I'm not sure that I can. There are no easy answers. The answers you're seeking aren't answers that anybody else can give you. You're going to have to look for them within yourself. And no, it's not going to be easy, my friend. But I'll pray for you, and my door is always open.
Thanks, Liam.
Don't mention it. I only wish I could do more.
You've already done a lot, old friend, said Steele, getting up. And I appreciate it.
Leaving already?
Yeah, I've got work to do, and I guess I've got to do a lot of thinking with this new brain of mine. This may be one problem a computer can't solve.
Take care of yourself, Donovan, said Father Casey, holding out his hand. God bless you.
You too.
And good luck.
Thanks. I think I'll need it.
The phone rang as he was sitting down to dinner. It was Susan.
Steele, are you watching television?
No.
Turn on Channel 7 right away. I'll call you back.
She hung up. He picked up the remote control and switched on the evening news. What he saw was a series of aerial shots taken from a chopper of his street battle with the dragons earlier in the day, but over the sounds of gunfire, they were using a voiceover. It was his own voice speaking. Linda Tellerman must have had the mic on while they were talking. She had edited the conversation and was running it over the tape of his battle with the dragons.
I'm a human being, Mrs. Tellerman, he heard himself say. Dressed the same as you are, only I was shot up and they replaced some of my parts with nice steel prosthetics. I still think the same way. I still have the same memories and the same feelings, but they put my personality into a cybernetic brain. I've got blood running through my veins, and I still have human heart beating in my chest, but my arms and legs are nice steel, and I've got circuitry inside my head. So you tell me if I'm human or not, Miss Tellerman. How do you like to wake up one day to find out they'd taken out your brain and programmed your personality into a computer that they'd stuck inside your skull? And how do you like to have to spend the rest of your life with people looking at you as if you're some sort of freak or monster? You're going to air your story to let people know about the new cyber cop on the police force, a new government super weapon to aid in the fight against crime. And the next time I come near a little girl like the one back there, she won't throw her arms around my neck like that one did. She'll probably scream and go running home to mother.
Zoom in on a tight shot of the bedraggled little girl clinging to him while he stroked her hair softly. Freeze frame. Voice over.
I don't want to be a freak show.
Cut to Leonard Tellerman in the studio. Looking at the freeze frame on the screen behind her, she turned to the camera. Her eyes were misty.
I don't want to be a freak show, she repeated, her voice full of feeling. The voice of a tortured man who has made the supreme sacrifice for the people of this city. A man who has become, in many ways, much more than an ordinary man. But the white little girl whose life he saved today knows him only as a gentleman, a protector, someone who cares enough to do whatever must be done to make this city safe for little children like herself, and for all the rest of us as well. Donovan Steele asks nothing in return except our understanding, and, perhaps, some compassion. The government may call him a cyborg, but to me, he'll always be Lieutenant Donovan Steele, Strike Force officer, a selfless and courageous human being, and the bravest man I've ever met. She swallowed hard and glanced down at the desk briefly. When she looked up again, her eyes were moist. Back to you, John, she said softly. The anchor man looked suitably grave.
Thank you, Linda. A fascinating, thought-provoking, and a very moving story. We'll be back in a moment. Steele turned off the TV. The phone rang almost immediately. He picked it up.
Susan!
It's Higgins, Steele. Did you see it?
Yeah, I saw.
Terrific job. That's exactly the sort of publicity we need. That shot with the little girl was pure gold. The phones here are ringing off the hooks. Every TV reporter and journalist in town wants to know about you. We're setting up a press conference here at the federal building first thing in the morning. We're going to have some legislators out there, and the mayor himself is going to. Steele hung up the phone. When it rang again, he didn't answer it. It could have been Susan, but he didn't feel like talking to her either. He went out the balcony and simply stood there, staring out the city for a long time. He wished he could get drunk, but alcohol would not dull the functioning of his cybernetic brain. Instead, he picked up the phone and called the Strike Force dispatcher.
This is Steele, he said. Give me a chopper pickup at my place. I'm going out to Harlem.
He walked west down 125th Street from Lenox, moving slowly, dressed in full Strike Force riot gear. If that hadn't made him conspicuous enough, his white face would have, especially since he wore no helmet. It wasn't late yet, though. It was growing dark, and there were still people on the streets, the poverty-stricken residents of No Man's Land sitting on their stoops in shabby clothes, bedraggled little black kids playing sidewalk games, their parents ever watchful for any signs of screamers, or the predators who prowled their neighborhood. He was considered one of them. As he approached, people quickly got up off their stoops and hurried back inside. Parents pulled their children back inside the buildings, heedless of their protests. Radios and television sets felt silent as he passed. To these people, he was trouble on the hoof. Okay, and they had more than enough of that already. Any place a Strike Force cop went in No Man's Land was liable to turn into a war zone at any moment. They were anxious to get out of the line of fire. If they knew who and what he was, it made no difference. He was a cop and he was white. That was enough. The only ones who didn't run from him were some of the hardest street characters and the junkies who probably didn't even know he was there, and the hookers who were out on the streets to make some money and were damned if some cop was going to interfere with business. In the early evening, before it got too late, the more adventurous businessmen from Midtown often told their wives they had to work late at the office so that they could go pick up one of the battered gypsy cabs that cruised the Midtown borders. None of the city cabs would dare to venture into Harlem and cruise the edges of No Man's Land, looking for an inexpensive thrill in the back seat. The gypsy cabs were all controlled by the gangs.
Here it was the Skulls, and they all knew where the action was. Sometimes the better-heeled citizens sent out their private security guards to pick up a certain type of girl and bring her back to Midtown for an hour or two. And sometimes a cruising cop might be in need of some diversion, so the hookers didn't run. They had no reason to. They knew that prostitution in no man's land wasn't something the police cared about one way or another, so they stood there in their slinky clothes, eyeing him brazenly as he approached. Steele came up to two of them and stopped. "Evening, honey," one of them said, a girl who couldn't have been over, couldn't have been a day over 16, but looked at least 20. "Looking for a good time?" Steele glanced at the gold chain around her neck. It had a tiny gold skull on it. It was both a badge and a warning. She was a gang member. Family. Handled with care or else. "I'm looking for a man named Ice," said Steele. "Never heard of him." "That chain around your neck says you have. It's worth $100 if you can take me to him." She stuck her tongue in her cheek, considering. "What you be wanting with him?" I want to finish a conversation we once had." "Let's see the $100. Steele shook his head. "You take me to Ice, you'll get the money." The two hookers exchanged glances. "$100 for her, too." "Forget it." He started to walk on. Hey, wait a minute." He paused and turned around. "Don't be in such a rush. I take you to him, honey."
"All right, let's go."
She shook his arm and walked with him down the block, then turned to a side street. "You sure you don't got any more money you want to spend? I can show you a good time, honey."
"No, thanks."
"Suit yourself." God damn it. She stopped at the entrance to a basement level walk down. There was gang graffiti on the wall. "Down here, honey," she said with a big smile. She took his hand and led him down the steps. They stepped through the door and onto a small, dimly lit club. The walls were covered with graffiti and a huge painting of a bloody skull with a snake crawling through the eye holes. There was a bar on one side of the room and the battered pool table in the center. There was a door at the back behind the bar and one on the other side of the room to the right of the pool table. A radio was playing music with a hard, syncopated beat tuned into one of the Midtown stations. The place was full of skulls. All conversation stopped as he came into the room with him. "Man looking for Ice," she said, quickly detaching himself from his side, moving around to the far side of the room. She smiled at him. The hard, black faces stared at him for a long moment. No one said anything. One of the gang members disappeared through the side door behind the bar. "That right?" one of the others said. "You looking for Ice?"
"Yeah," said Steele.
"What do you want with him?"
"That's none of your business."
Several of them smirked and exchanged glances. "Suppose we make it our business, officer." The man spat out the word officer as if it were a curse.
"You're welcome to try,"
said Steele. He heard a bolt being drawn back. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see the man behind the bar holding an assault rifle pointed at him. "I think it just became our business," the man who had spoken earlier said with a smile. Steele's hand flashed down into his holster with incredible speed, and the .44 roared inside the closed confines of the basement. The man with the assault rifle flew back against the row of bottles behind him, shattering the mirror. He fell behind the bar, a bullet through his head. Instantly, Steele snapped the gun back and aimed it at the man who'd spoken.
"Where's Ice?"
The man stared at him, slack-jawed with amazement. Out of the corner of his eye, Steele saw one of the gang members reaching for his pocket. He switched on his laser designator and stared at the man.
"You better be reaching for a sandwich," he said, "because you're going to eat it."
The gang member stared at the two glowing red pinpricks in his eyes. His own two eyes bugged out, and he swallowed hard and slowly took his empty hand out of his pocket. The door in the back opened, and a handsome, slim young black man came out, wearing gang colors over his bare chest. Steele recognized Akeem from the talk show. Akeem took a glance around, sizing up the situation. He stared hard at Steele, then glanced behind the bar. When he looked back at Steele once again, his eyes were feral.
"Man, you just bought into a pile of trouble," he said.
"It's him," one of the others said. "That cyborg they was talking about on the news."
"That right?" asked Akeem, his eyes narrowed. "That right," said Steele. "And if trouble's what you want, I can handle all you got."
Akeem stared at him. "What you want with Ice?"
"That's between me and him."
"You the one got shot up in the meeting with him when he tried to sell us out?"
"That's right."
Akeem nodded. "Ice done crawled down some hole," he said. "They're a contract on the man. You fixing to collect?"
"I got my own contract," said Steele. "On Victor Borodini. I'm fixing to collect on that one."
Akeem snorted. "He scattered your pieces all over the pavement, man, and I think maybe we help him." Steele could hear soft footsteps through the door coming down the steps outside behind him.
"Anyone who helps Victor Borodini gets the same thing that's coming to him."
said Steele. He turned up his hearing and heard a hand grasping the doorknob behind him, turning it softly. He suddenly turned quickly and yanked open the door. A skull came tumbling through it. Steele clubbed him with his left hand, crushing his skull, and then fired three rapid shots into the stairwell, accounting for a gang member with each one. He slammed the door shut and quickly leapt aside. A bullet slammed onto the door. One of the gang members behind him had pulled a 9mm semi-auto. Steele brought up his .44 and shot him right between the eyes. The young hooker bolted through one of the side doors. Automatic weapons fire burst through the door as the gang members on the other side opened up. The skulls scattered. Several of them leapt over the bar. Others pulled out weapons and started firing. Steele felt several bullets rip into his chest and arms. He lunged out and grabbed the nearest man to him and used him as a shield. The skull's body jerked as bullets struck it, and Steele fired from behind him, dropping three others. He fired again, dropped another one, then hurled the body of the one he'd been using as a shield, throwing him across the room one-handed. The corpse struck several of the gang members, bowling them over. As the ones behind the bar came up with weapons, Steele lifted the pool table with one hand, setting it on end. Bullets struck it, piercing through the wood. Steele turned and fired, dropping a gang member to his left, then holstered the empty pistol, picked up the pool table, and hurled it at the bar. The skulls hiding behind the bar screamed as it struck with a resounding splash, splintering and smashing through the bar. Steele turned and kicked open the door behind him, the one the young hooker had gone through, knocking it clear off his hinges. He ran down the narrow corridor towards a flight of stairs at the end. Bullets whizzed past his ear as an automatic weapon crackled behind him. He pulled the handheld grenade launcher from his holster and snapped off a shot back down the corridor. The building shook as the grenade round went off, the walls and ceiling falling in and sealing off the corridor. Steele made it to the top of the steps and kicked open a door that led into an alley. They were waiting for him. Several assault rifles opened up at him once, the impact of the bullets throwing him back against the wall. He unholstered the .45 Colt, and though he couldn't see them all, his cybernetic brain analyzed the direction of fire, and his laser designator homed in. He fired once, dropping one, hit the ground, and rolled. Fired again as he came up, taking out another gunman crouching down behind a dumpster. He pivoted and fired once more, taking out the third on the fire escape above him. He holstered the Colt as he ran towards the street, unslinging his 4.7mm battle rifle. Several armed figures showed at the mouth of the alley, and he opened fire on full auto as he ran straight at them, mowing them all down. He hit the street at full speed, running back to the front of the club. He switched the select fire mode on the rifle to three-round bursts and took out three more gang members as they came out the front door of the club. Someone opened up on him from an upstairs window, and without even looking, he brought the rifle up one-handed and snapped off a three-round burst. A gang member's body came flying down from the window up on the fourth floor. Steele stood in the middle of the street, unholstered his grenade launcher, and put two rounds through the front entrance of the clubs. Screams ran out as the explosive rounds went off, and the whole front of the club entrance collapsed in a shower of brick and concrete. Overhead, he heard the sound of chopper blades. He looked up and saw the Channel 7 chopper hovering above the street, undoubtedly filming the whole thing. He cursed under his breath, ejected the magazine from the pistol grip of his grenade launcher, and snapped in one containing smoke-emitting rounds. He fired four times at the street in rapid succession, boxing the points of the compass, laying down smoke all around himself. It billowed up, obscuring most of the street. When it began to clear, the street was empty. There was no sign of him. "Where'd he go?" shouted Linda Tellerman up in the chopper. "I don't know," the pilot said. "He must have taken off down one of the side streets. Want me to fly around and see if I can find him?" "No, never mind," she said. "We've got more than enough for the 11 o'clock show. Let's head back. We can get him the next time he comes out." She grinned at the pilot. "That boy's going to make me a star." The door slammed open, the glass in its window shattering, as Steele stormed into the communications room at the police headquarters. "Jesus Christ, Lieutenant, what?" He shoved the sergeant out of the way and went around behind the partition to the dispatcher's cubicle. The startled dispatcher looked up to him as he approached. Steele reached out over the partition and lifted him right up out the chair. The dispatcher's headset tore off as Steele hauled him one-handed right over the partition. "Steele, what the hell? Have you gone crazy?" said the communications sergeant, coming up behind him. "How much is Channel 7 paying you to tip them off wherever I go?" he demanded of the wide-eyed dispatcher. I don't know what you're talking about." Steele lifted him up with one hand and swung him around, slamming him against one of the plastic partitions. It cracked and buckled as the dispatcher struck it. "I said how much?" "Ah, Jesus. All right. $200 for every tip." "Who else is in on this scam?" he demanded. "No, nobody else. Just me." Steele slammed him against the partition once again. This time it shattered completely. "I said who else?" Okay. Koblinski, Bloomberg, and Scarpetti. "That's it. I swear to God. Just the four of us. Come on, Lieutenant. Let me go, please. You're hurting me." Steele dropped him and the dispatcher collapsed to the floor. "One on each shift," he said with disgust. The communications sergeant stood behind him, staring at the dispatcher. "You've been tipping off the news media," he said with disbelief. "Twice now I've gone out on a scat drop, and the Channel 7 chopper was right there on the scene each time," said Steele. "Too much of a coincidence." I can't believe it, said the sergeant. He stared at the dispatcher who was picking himself off the floor. You're making money from the TV news? Hey, come on, Sarge, protested the dispatcher. Where's the harm? All they wanted was some good footage, that's all. What's wrong with picking up a few bucks on the side, especially if it's good PR for the department? And did you pick up a few bucks for telling them where I live, too? Asked Steele. The dispatcher bit his lower lip and looked down at the floor. You son of a bitch, said the communications sergeant. Turn in your badge, Roberts. You're suspended. And when Kablinski, Bloomberg, and Scarpetti come in, I want to see them at my desk immediately. The sergeant glanced around at the stunned personnel in the communications section. And as for the rest of you, if I find out anyone else is taking payoffs to tip the news media to police actions, I'll personally rip your goddamn lungs out. Is that clear? He turned back to Steele. I'm really sorry about this, Lieutenant. It won't happen again. I guarantee it. Thanks, said Steele. He scowled. Sorry about the mess. Don't give it another thought. Roberts, get a broom. A police scat chopper delivered him to the helipad of his penthouse apartment. A call to his building security confirmed what he had already suspected. The news media were there in force. Channel 7 may have paid for the information. It wasn't long after they got his address that they lost their exclusive. Building security was keeping the reporters out of the lobby, but they were waiting for him outside on the street, and Susan Carmody was waiting for him inside the apartment. Steele, she said, coming out on the balcony when she heard the chopper touch down briefly to drop him off. I tried to call you. I wasn't answering the phone. Right after the news broadcast, Higgins called.
I know, she said. He called me after you hung up on him. He wants me to talk to you into going to that press conference.
To hell with that idea, Steele said. He glanced over the balcony railing down to the street below. He could see the reporters clustered in on the sidewalk out in front of the building entrance. RSD warned me about this, he said. The security people downstairs said calls have been coming in all evening. Damn dispatcher gave out my address. Looks like I'm going to have to move. The freak show started.
Steele,
she said, touching his arm. Her hands recoiled. She was staring at his arm where the large caliber bullets had torn away the cloth of his uniform and the polymer skin beneath it, exposing the gleaming nice steel workings underneath. She backed away a few steps, looking down, and saw where the metal was exposed upon his legs and hips as well.
My God, what happened?
She said. The machine took a little wear and tear out there in the field, he said. Guess I'll have to come in for some body work. Tell Higgins to break out the grinders and the buffing wheels.
Steele, don't.
Isn't that what you people wanted? He said harshly. A little field testing to see how well I'd hold up? Well, the prosthetics held up for under fire just fine, but the skin is going to take a little work. It's not quite strong enough. Maybe if you mixed in some more epoxy or something.
Stop it! Stop it!
What's the matter, doctor? You're not squeamish at the sight of a little motor oil, are you? She shook her head.
Why are you doing this to me?
Why the hell did you do this to me? He countered. A tear slid down her cheek.
I'm sorry, she said. I just thought I won't be bothering you anymore.
She turned to leave. Susan, wait! Don't leave! She turned, her cheeks wet with tears. Please don't leave, he said. I need you. She came into his arms. He held her close. I didn't mean what I said.
I'm sorry,
she said, sobbing into his shoulder. I'm sorry, too. The sound of a helicopter's blades filled the air above them as the helicopter swooped down low over the roof. Steele looked up and saw the Channel 4 news logo on the side. God damn it, he said. Leave me the hell alone! He shouted at the man leaning out the hatch with a minicam. Only it wasn't a minicam. The machine gun cracked as 50 caliber bullets alternating with tracer rounds smashed into the balcony around them, shattering the sliding glass doors behind them and taking chunks out of the wall. Get down! Shouted Steele, pushing Susan to the ground and clawing for the grenade launcher in the holster on his hip. He felt the bullets smashing to his arms and legs and chest. Pain exploded as one grazed the side of his face and another struck his head, and then he tuned it out, bringing up the grenade pistol. The chopper quickly started to gain altitude as Steele switched to his laser designator, tracked him, and squeezed off four rounds, one right after the other. The chopper exploded in a ball of fire, and the reporters down below scattered as the wreckage rained down on the street.
Borodini, Steele said through gritted teeth. Bastard didn't waste much time. Are you all right, Susan?
He turned and saw her lying on the floor of the balcony, her limp body in a huge, rapidly spreading pool of blood.
Susan!
He dropped the grenade pistol and bent down over her, kneeling in the blood. He gently turned her over. Her body was chewed up, riddled with bullets. Her eyes were wide open, staring sightlessly up at the sky.
Oh, God, he said softly. Oh, God, no.
When the building's security guards burst through his door, they found him kneeling on the balcony, holding Susan's lifeless body in his arms, covered in her blood. The sight of him brought them up short. There were gaping holes in his uniform and body armor where the bullets had struck, revealing the gleaming metal underneath. He was bleeding badly. A large chunk of polymer flesh was missing from his head, exposing the nice steel skull casing. Part of the left side of his face was shot away. It was a mass of blood, teeth, and shattered jawbone, but he didn't feel any pain, at least not from his wounds. Lieutenant, one of the security men said. Lieutenant Steele? He looked at the man slowly. Lieutenant, she's dead, sir. Steele nodded.
Yeah, I know,
he said dully. Come on, sir. Agency chopper's on the way. You're hurt. We've got to get you some help.
Leave me alone.
The guards glanced at one another. The man in charge nodded. Two of them went out into the hall. The others went out to the helipad and took up their posts, their weapons held at the ready, awaiting the arrival of the chopper. Steele brushed the blood-soaked hair back out of Susan's face.
I'm sorry too, Susan, he said softly. I'm sorry too.
End of chapter.